For those of you who don't know him or didn't witness it, here's the deal. Roy was a patient here. For the most part, he was an exemplary patient. He worked hard on himself, he worked hard on his program, he listened and he followed all of our rules. When he left a week or so ago, I, along with most of the rest of the staff, was confident in his prospects for a long-term recovery. Last night at about 3:30, he snuck past security, entered this facility, and came down to the unit. He was carrying a large stick and he climbed on top of that couch. He points to one of the couches. He started screaming. Security was called and I was on the night shift, and when we came down here and confronted him, he claimed to be someone named Jack, and he threatened to beat us with the stick. He was subdued and removed from the unit and taken to the medical unit and examined. From there, he was taken to a mental institution. At this point, we believe with fair certainty that Roy suffers from MPD, which stands for Multiple Personality Disorder. For those of you who don't know what MPD is, it is a psychological condition in which two or more distinct identities, each with its own pattern of perceiving, relating to and thinking about the environment and self, exist within a single person. Although some of the personalities know of each other, often they do not, and they can exist entirely independent of one another for great lengths of time. Last night we observed at least four, and possibly five, separate personalities existing within Roy. One of them was the guy we came to know while he was here. It was a very sad and upsetting night last night. I was Roy's counselor, and I was very proud of him, and the work we did together while he was here. I hope all of you will say a prayer for him in whatever way it is that you pray. Any questions? The bald man speaks.
How'd you not know about this with all the tests and everything?
Except for a couple of incidents, which I am viewing differently in retrospect, his primary and dominant personality was the person who was here. If that person was taking all the tests and doing all the work, we would have no way of knowing anything else was going on. One of the new men speaks. He is tall and skinny, and wears black designer glasses.
Is this common?
No, I've never seen it before, and as far as I know, nobody else here has either. Miles speaks.
Is there treatment for it?
Long-term psychiatric care, support groups, intensive therapy. Most of the treatment methods are similar to what are used for other profound and incurable mental illnesses.
Ted speaks.
I got a question.
What?
Ted speaks. I never liked Roy, so I'm wondering if you could bring him back here with his bitch personality so that I could slap his ass around a bit.
Everybody laughs.
Lincoln stares, speaks.
Not funny, Ted.
I ain't trying to be funny. I want to bitch slap that motherfucker.
Moore laughs.
Lincoln shakes his head, tries to ignore Ted.
Any other questions?
Nobody speaks. Lincoln stands.
Let's get our afternoon started. Fourth step group, stay here. Third step group, up top. The rest of you do your individual assignments. James, come with me to Joanne's office. The men go to their areas of group assignments or off on their own. I get up and I walk with Lincoln to Joanne's office. He does not speak to me and I do not speak to him. Neither of us looks at the other. When we get there, he knocks on the door. We hear Joanne's voice from behind.
Come in.
He opens the door. We step inside. Joanne is sitting behind her desk. She motions for us to sit. Lincoln sits on the couch. I take a chair between the couch and the desk. Joanne speaks.
Hi, James. How are you?
Fine. You?
I'm fine. She holds up my first step workbook. Care to explain this?
I laugh. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Lincoln speaks, an edge of anger in his voice.
It's completely unacceptable. That and your goal are an insult to what we're trying to do with you.
I thought that fucking book was an insult to my intelligence, and my goal is a joke. I put it up there because it makes me laugh, and laughing makes me feel good, and that's my only goal, to feel good. When I feel good, I feel like I'm getting better.
Joanne speaks.
I understand your intentions, James, though I'm not sure they're appropriate.
Lincoln speaks.
They aren't.
Joanne speaks.
We try to plan a patient's recovery program and their future after they leave here, as they are working through what we do and what we teach. At this point, you're not as far along as we would like. You seem to have some grasp of the first step.
I laugh.
Why are you laughing?
I speak. The first step, if I remember correctly, says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and drugs, that our lives had become unmanageable. I have a fairly sound grasp of that concept.
Lincoln speaks.
You're sure of that?
I'm wanted in 3 states. I'm addicted to alcohol and crack. I'm unemployed, unemployable, and completely broke. I've blacked out every night for as long as I can remember, and my time in here is the longest stretch of sobriety I've known since I was 10 years old. I am out of control. If you want to hear me say it, I'll say it. I am out of fucking control. My life is unmanageable.
Joanne speaks.
We're not the enemy, James.
I know you're not.
Lincoln speaks. Don't treat us like we are.
Don't treat me like an idiot. Talk to me like I'm a fucking baby and waste my time with coloring books, and I won't treat you like the enemy.
Lincoln shakes his head.
Joanne speaks.
Getting back to the subject,
you are not as far along as we would like. You are resistant to everything we tell you. We don't think that you'll be ready to move into a normalized existence once this program is over. If you're not facing jail time, and that is something we would like to start working on by contacting the authorities in the states in which you have issues, we want to put you on a waiting list for a halfway house.
What would I do there?
It would be a lot like this, except you'd be expected to hold a job during the day.
No way.
Lincoln speaks.
Why?
Because that's not going to work for me.
Why?
I'm starting to figure out how I think I can do this. I won't know until I'm in the real world and until I can test myself. That test will not be real to me if I know that I can go running back to the safety of some halfway house.
Joanne speaks.
There is no such thing as safety when you're dealing with a profound and incurable addiction. Halfway houses offer support, and you're going to need all the support you can get. You're going to need it when you leave here, a month later, a year after that, and most likely for the rest of your life.
I don't want safety or support. I want there to be me and whatever I have to face, be it alcohol or drugs or something else. I want there to be a fight because I know how to fight. There will be a winner of that fight. If it's me, I walk away, and I have beat the shit that I didn't think I could ever beat, and I move on with life. If it's not me, at least I get it over with.
Lincoln speaks.
If you don't survive your little test, you're going to die. Is that what you want to do? Die?
If I can't stay sober, it is.
You won't stay sober if you keep doing what you're doing.
Why do you think that?
It's not what I think, it's what I know. I know it because every time someone comes in here thinking they have a better way, they walk out of here and they fall and they don't get back up.
You may be right, but at least I'll fall knowing I did the best I could with what I believed in.
Joanne speaks.
I don't like this idea of a test. I think it's dangerous, foolish, and stubborn. I think the stakes are too high for you if it doesn't work out. I want you to think about that. To really think about the idea that your resistance to what we're trying to do with you may cause your death. Meet me here tomorrow after morning lecture, and you and I will talk about things and hopefully move forward.
I stand.
Do I need to do anything else this afternoon?
Just think.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I walk to the door, and I walk out, and I shut the door behind me, and I walk back to the unit. I go to my room and I look at the clock next to Miles's bed. It reads 3:42. I am meeting Lily in 18 minutes. I get Hank's jacket. I put it on and I walk through the unit. I open one of the glass doors and I step outside.
I walk through the grass. There is no dew, and I find the trail, and I enter the wood. There is sun streaming through gaps in the trees like girders of light. I walk along the trail. I see broken branches, and I see torn leaves spread like crumbs. And the torn leaves lead me. The signs of my destruction lead me. I push my way through the thick, and I step into the clearing. It is empty. I sit down on the dirt, and I lie back, and I close my eyes. I have not slept enough, and I am tired. I need more sleep. I am tired. Tired. I am tired. I feel a hand on my face. It's soft and warm, resting on my cheek, caressing it without moving. Lips follow it on the other cheek, full and wet and soft and gentle. There is sweet breath behind and sweet breath after. They both leave my cheek. I wish they would stay. I open my eyes and I slowly sit up. Lily is next to me, bundled in a large green army jacket, black hair in braided pigtails, her pale skin reflecting a girder of sun. She smiles and she speaks. Hi. What time is it? She looks at a cheap plastic superwoman watch on her wrist. Beneath it, I see scars. 4:10. I rub my face. I fell asleep. She smiles again. I woke you up. I smile. I'm glad. She leans forward, and she kisses me on the cheek. She holds her lips soft, wet, warm, and gentle. My instinct is to pull away, but I don't. When she pulls away, she leaves sweet breath behind her. Answer a question for me. Okay. Do you have a girlfriend? I hesitate, a flash of her, arctic and blonde. No. Why'd you hesitate? I did, but I don't anymore. I thought of her for a second. Where is she? I have no idea. When was the last time you spoke to her? About a year ago. You over her? No. Lily smiles, leans forward, and she kisses my lips. That's too bad. I smile. I have no words. If I did have words, they would mean nothing. You want to smoke? She reaches into one of the pockets of her jacket and she pulls out a pack of cigarettes. Yeah. I take one. You got a lighter? I reach into my pocket, pull out a lighter. Yeah. I flip it, light her smoke, light mine. You having a good day? I inhale. I feel the nicotine immediately. It doesn't feel as good as Lily's kiss. It's been long. She inhales, stares at me. They're all long in here. My instinct is to look away, but I don't. Yeah. Tell me something. All right. Why are you here? Here at this place, or here with you? Either one. I don't know. She smiles. That's a good answer. My instinct is to look away, but I don't. I speak. Why are you here? She smiles. Here at this place, or here with you? I smile. Either. I came to this place because of my grandma. She brought you in? She convinced me to bring myself in. How'd she do that? She loved me, and she took care of me, even though I was a total disaster, and whenever I did something stupid, which was pretty much every day, she told me that when I was ready to learn about freedom, I should come talk to her. A while back, something really, really awful happened. It fucked me up bad, and I went and found her, and I asked her what she meant. She told me that I was a prisoner of my mom, and all of her problems, and a prisoner of my dad, who I don't remember, and she told me that I was a prisoner of drugs and sex and of myself. She told me that living life as a prisoner was a waste of life, and that freedom, even a second of freedom, was worth more than a lifetime of bondage. She told me, if I wanted to learn more, to come talk to her again the next day. I did, and she told me the same thing. A second of freedom is worth more than a lifetime of bondage.
Then she said, come back again the next day. I did. And she handed me a map, and she said, let's get in the car, you're driving. 8 hours later, that map led me here. She said she had been saving money for 3 years, and if I wanted freedom, I should walk in the front doors and she'd pay for it. She said if I didn't, we should drive home. I hate my life. I have never wanted it to be the way it has been, and this was a chance to escape it. I had heard of this place, and knew it was the best place like it, and really expensive. And I knew if Grandma had saved for me to be here, that she wanted it from me, and I knew I wanted it as well. To be free, even if it's just for a second. So I walked through the doors, and here I am. You free yet? No, but I'm getting there. She smiles. You tell me a story now.
About what?
Tell me about your girlfriend.
I don't like talking about her.
Why?
Because it hurts too much.
Fair enough. Tell me something else.
Pick something.
How'd you lose your virginity?
Why do you want to know that?
It says a lot about a person.
It won't say good things about me.
I'm not here to judge you. Why are you here? To know you. Or to try.
I stare at her. I stare at her eyes, clean water blue, and her hair braided jet black. I stare at her skin, pale white, and her lips blood red. I stare at her body beneath the jacket. She is so small. I stare at her wrists and the Superwoman watch and the scars running vertically. I stare at me, but not me. I see the damage and pain of hard years. I see the emptiness and desperation of existence without hope. I see a young life that has been too long. I see me, but not me. I trust myself. I can trust her. I've never told anyone this.
You don't have to tell me if you don't want to.
No, I will.
Stop whenever you want.
I stare at her. I see me, but not me. I can trust her. I speak. I was 16, a sophomore in high school. It was homecoming, and there was a football game and a dance. I hated the town we lived in, and my parents knew I hated it, and they felt bad about it. My mom would always ask me about friends and girls because she hoped I would meet some people and then I'd be happier. I always lied to her and told her that I had lots of friends and that lots of girls liked me so that she wouldn't feel so bad. The reality of the situation was that nobody liked me. As this dance was coming up, my mom kept asking if I was going. I told her I hadn't decided yet, that there were a couple of girls who wanted to go with me, and I wasn't sure which one I liked most, and I really just hoped she'd stop asking. She didn't. Every day it was the same.
Who are you going to ask? You should decide soon. You need to give the girl enough time to get ready. It's a special night. You shouldn't miss it.
Finally, I just lied to her and told her I was taking someone. She was really excited, and she went out, and she got me a suit, and she bought me a rose to pin on my lapel, and she washed her car and told me I could borrow it, and she gave me some money to go out to dinner before the game. It fucking sucked because I knew it was all bullshit, and I was lying to her. When the day of the game came around, I put on the suit, and she and my dad took a bunch of pictures of me, and I waved out the car window as I drove away. I parked the car near the school stadium, and I sat and watched all the other kids, the ones who had dates, as they drove in and hung around in the stands or on the sidelines in their suits and dresses. And I watched the halftime ceremony, and I watched the king and queen get crowned, and I watched everyone clap and cheer for them, and I watched everyone be happy. When the game was over, I didn't have anything to do, and I sure wasn't going to go to the dance alone, so I drove to this ghetto nearby to try and score some drugs, because I felt like shit for lying to my mom, and because I didn't have any friends, and I wanted to make the pain go away. As I was driving around, I saw a whore walking on the street near a house where I used to buy. She would stare at me and wave at me as I passed, and I couldn't find any drugs, so I finally just pulled over.
She walked up to the car and asked if I wanted a date. And I said how much, and she told me. And it was just a little bit less than the money my mom had given me, so I said yes. I don't know why I did it. I guess I was just lonely and sad and hoping to find some sort of love that would make me feel better. What happened was awkward and stupid and disgusting. The woman smelled and talked to me in this fake, dirty voice, and it was over in about 2 seconds. I took her back to the street, and I drove around for the next couple hours trying to talk myself out of driving full speed into a tree. When I went home, I told my mom and dad I had a great time, and I thanked them for everything they gave me, and I went to my room. When I knew they were asleep, I stole a bottle from their liquor cabinet and drank it and cried myself to sleep. I take a deep breath, stare at the ground. It fucking sucked. And to be honest, I want to kill myself right now even thinking about it. I hate that it happened. And like most everything in my life, it was not what I had hoped for. I stare at the ground. If there was a hole deep enough, I would climb in. If there were drugs that could obliterate all, I would take them until all was obliterated. I want to kill myself right now, even thinking about it. I look up. There are tears running down Lily's cheek, and she is smiling at me. It is a deep smile, not the type of momentary happiness, but the rare kind that comes when something inside, without words, is woken from slumber and brought forth to live. Though I know it will disappear from her face, it will stay in her, and with her long after it does. It has woken, and it will live. I reach up, and I gently wipe her tears away. Her skin is soft, and the wetness is warm on my hand. As my fingers slide from her chin, she takes them into her own hand, and she holds them. She stares at me with eyes clean, water blue, thicker now with lament. Her smile not gone, she speaks.
That was beautiful.
She is holding my hand. No, it wasn't. If she let go, I would fall apart.
It was. It was beautiful because it was honest, and it was beautiful because it hurt, and it was beautiful because you didn't have to tell it to me.
Fall apart. It makes me feel like shit.
What if I told you I lost my virginity as a whore instead of with one?
I would say I'm sorry.
I did.
I'm sorry. She smiles.
Thank you.
She looks at her watch with her free hand, looks at me.
We should go.
She stands and she pulls me up with her. We stare at each other for a moment, and she puts her free hand on my cheek. She does not let go of my hand with her other hand, and I am glad she doesn't.
I'll call you tonight.
Good.
You don't have to, but I'd like it if you took the call this time.
I smile. I fell asleep last night.
You can fall asleep tonight if you want as well, but I hope you don't.
I won't. She leans forward, and she kisses me. Though it is the same as before, it isn't the same at all. It is more, stronger, weaker, deeper, quieter, louder. It is more, vulnerable, impenetrable, fragile, secure, unprotected, completely protected. It is more open, deeper, full, simpler, true. It is more true. She pulls away her lips, pull away. Without words, we walk hand in hand through the thick wood. At the dense edge near the trail, she stops and she guides me forward, and our hands slide slowly apart until there are two fingers, one each of our fingers touching, not wanting to let go or be away. I stop. I let my finger, the tip of my finger, touch hers, the tip of her finger. We stare at each other. Her smile has not gone away, and mine will not either. It will be there when I am not smiling. It will still be there. A smile and a kiss, and the tips of two fingers. Touching. She nods, and I know the nod means it is time to let go, and I do. I turn and I walk away. I know she's watching me walk away, smiling.
and I know she wants me to turn around.
I do.
I turn around and she is there, and she is smiling.
I smile back, and it is more than just a smile, it is more.
I make my way back to the unit. I walk in and I walk through the halls to dinner. Every meal is now the same. After dinner there is a lecture, a man telling his life story. He was bad, and he joined AA, and now he's good. I have heard it too many times. I go back to the unit, and I sit, and I watch TV. There is a sitcom about some witty New Yorkers who spend all of their time in one apartment. One of the men praises the show, and he talks about how real it is. The only people I know who spend so much time in one apartment usually have black plastic taped over the windows and guns in the closet, and burn marks on their lips and fingers and huge locks on the doors. They are not witty people, though their paranoia can be amusing. I don't see anything like that on this show, but it is supposedly very real. Maybe I don't know what real is anymore. The phone rings. The phone has been ringing all night. This ring, however, draws my attention. Somehow I know it is Lily, even though I shouldn't, and even though I have no reason to know that it is Lily. I stand, and I am walking before the man calls out my name. As he does, I take the receiver, and I thank him, and I put the receiver to my ear, and I speak.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You?
I'm good.
I miss you.
I laugh.
You miss me?
Yeah, I miss you. Why is that funny?
No one has ever missed me before. People tend to be happy when I'm gone.
She laughs.
Not me.
Good. I like that you miss me.
I like it too.
I smile.
What did you do tonight?
Sat here and watched the clock until I thought I could call you without seeming desperate.
I laugh. What did you do?
Sat here and waited for you to call, and thought about what I was going to say to you so that I didn't sound desperate.
She laughs, speaks.
I guess we're desperate.
Probably a bit.
For what?
Freedom. However we can find it.
And you think one of those forms could be each other?
Maybe.
It wasn't what I expected when I came here.
You shouldn't expect anything now. You should just wait and see what happens.
Well said. Thank you. You want to meet me again tomorrow?
Sure.
You can tell me another story.
I think it's your turn.
I think you're right.
You got anything in mind?
Ask me a question, same as I did to you, and I'll give you an answer.
And whatever that answer is, I won't judge you.
Thank you.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I miss you.
I like that you miss me.
I like that you like it.
Bye.
Bye.
I put the receiver in the cradle, and I stare at the phone, and I smile. It's not just a smile of momentary happiness. When it disappears from my face, it will stay with me. I turn, and I walk through the unit, and into the hall and toward my room. As I approach it, I can hear the soft sounds of Miles's clarinet drifting through the door. I stop outside, and I listen to it. He is playing low like he always plays low. He is holding the notes for longer than I would think he'd be able to hold them. He is repeating a melody over and over, each time with variations. It is simple music, made by one man, and his lungs, and a piece of metal with holes and his fingers moving along the holes. It is just sound, low, then higher, slow, then faster, slow again, and low, repeated with variations. There are no words, and there is no singing, but the music has a voice. It is an old voice, and a deep voice, like the stump of a sweet cigar, or a shoe with a hole. It is a voice that has lived and lives, with sorrow and shame, ecstasy and bliss, joy and pain, redemption and damnation. It is a voice with love and without love. I like the voice, and though I can't talk to it, I like the way it talks to me. It says, "It is all the same, young man. Take it, and let it be." The song, the melody, the old, low and slow voice ends. It ends and it trails off into the quiet of a sleeping hall.
I open the door, and I step into my room. Miles, sitting on his bed, his lips are still holding the reed. He nods to me, and I nod back to him. I walk over to my bed. I take off my clothes, and I climb beneath the covers of my bed, and they are warm, and I like them. And I close my eyes, and I curl into myself, my head against the pillow. I curl into myself, and the voice begins again. Sorrow and shame and ecstasy and bliss and joy and pain and redemption and damnation and love and without. It is all the same, young man. Take it and let it be. I have an empty bottle in one hand. I have an empty pipe in the other. I am standing on a street corner littered with trash. There are shoes hanging from the telephone wires. The ghosts of the rock are screaming. Dealers are hawking their wares. I have an empty bottle in one hand. I have an empty pipe in the other. I'm looking for more. I wake shaking and shaken. I know I was dreaming, but it doesn't matter. The liquor was real. The crack was real. The ghosts were real and the dealers were real. It was all real. I am shaking and shaken. I put my arms around myself. I curl into a ball. I think about what is good in my life. I try to occupy my mind. I have been sober for a few weeks. I have friends, Maddie and Ed and Ted, Miles and Leonard and Lily. I have a brother, Bob. I have some clothes and I have some books. It is more than enough. Roaring pit bulls straining chains, a dead grass yard. Rats scurry across the floor. They bite sleeping faces. An empty house, no furniture, nothing. It is empty but for empty people, the ghosts of the rock. There is smoke in the air mixed with gas and formaldehyde. I am screaming, screaming, pleading, begging for more. Give me more, please give me more. I want, need, have to have more. I'll give my life, heart, soul, money, future, everything. Please give me more. I want, need, have to have more. Give me more, and I'll give you everything. Give me more, and I'll do whatever you want. Give me more, give me more, give me more. I wake, shaking and shaken. I know I was dreaming, but it doesn't matter. It was real. The dogs, the rats, the house, the people, the rock. The great and terrible rock. It was real, and I smoked it. I am shaking and shaken. I curl tighter, try to think of the good. I have more than I need, more than enough. Curl tighter. Think of the good. Think of the good. Another dream. Another dream. Each time I sleep, another dream. They are real. Real. Another dream. I am shaking and shaken. I can see light through the window. I stand. I am unsteady as I walk to the bathroom. I open the door and I fall to my knees and I crawl to the toilet and I am sick. Over and over again I am violently sick. It is another reminder of the life I have lived. The sickness and the blood and the bile and the chunks of my stomach sitting in the water beneath my nose. Another reminder. I stand up and I step into the shower and I turn on the heat. I step under the stream and I let the water run down and across and over and off of me. I fight the urge to vomit again. I am fucking tired of being sick. They were only dreams. This can't keep happening. They were only dreams. I step out and I grab a towel and I wrap it around my waist and I walk to the sink and I brush my teeth. The taste of my sickness mixes with the taste of my toothpaste. I wash my mouth, but the taste doesn't go away. I wash it again, and it doesn't go away. I wash it again. It is not going away. I stop washing my mouth, and I shave. As I stand in front of the mirror with the razor, I look at my body. I am getting bigger. I am acquiring flesh. The veins on my arms are still blue, but they are a lighter blue. The bones of my cheek and the line of my jaw are less defined. The bruises that covered me are gone. There is a thin layer of fat over all of me, and I am starting to get a belly. I look less like what I am and more like a human being. I am becoming more like a human being. I finish shaving and I rinse the residue from my face. I take a deep breath and I look at the base of the mirror and I start to move slowly up. I see my chest, my collarbone, the base of my neck. I want to see my eyes. I see my throat, my Adam's apple, the curve of my neck into my chin. I want to see my eyes. I see my lips. They are healed. I see my cheek. It is scarred. I see my nose, no longer swollen. I see the area beneath my eyes. It has bags, but they are gray bags of wear, not the black and yellow bags of violence. There is green above them, pale green. As I move toward it, I stop and I breathe. I hold beneath pale green. I can see the lash below. I can see the white beneath. I breathe. It's there. I hold and it's there, pale green. I turn around. I walk out of the bathroom. Miles is still sleeping. I try to be quiet. I get dressed and I walk out of my room. The hall is still asleep. I walk into the upper level of the unit and I make the coffee. I wait for it to brew. When it is ready, I pour myself a tall cup, steaming hot and black. I sit at a table and I light a cigarette. I am alone. I sit and I drink and I smoke. I don't think about what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. I just sit there alone. I drink and I smoke. One of the sliding glass doors opens. I look down and I see Leonard walking into the lower level of the unit. He is wearing a jogging outfit and his face is red. It is dripping with sweat. He looks as if he is in better shape than when I met him. He's thin, his jawline is visible, his cheeks are flush. He looks like a healthy suburban father coming home from a jog. He sees me, walks toward me. "What's up, Leonard?"
"Out for a run."
"How was it?"
"It sucked."
He gets a cup of coffee, sits down at the table.
"You got one of those for me?"
"I didn't think you smoked. I just did something good to my body. Now I want to do something bad to it." I laugh, hand him a smoke, light it. He takes a deep drag, looks at me.
"I hear you're seeing that girl with the black hair."
"What girl?"
"The crackhead."
"Where'd you hear that?" "I never betray a source." "We're friends, but that's not going to stop me from beating your ass if you don't tell me who told you that." He laughs.
"Ted told me."
"How would he know?"
"He sneaks out every night and meets some girl in the woods.
I guess that girl is on the same unit as your girl. And if you didn't know by now, girls talk about that shit." "There's not much to talk about."
"Not much means there's something."
"I met her out there a couple times. We talk. It's no big deal."
"You like her?"
"Yeah."
"She good to you?"
"There's no good or bad. We just talk."
"You look different right now. That's a good sign."
I smile. "You're making a big deal out of nothing, Leonard."
"I'm only interested in your happiness, kid. If you're happy, I'm happy."
"I'm not happy, but I'm not unhappy."
"You'll be happy soon. Just hold on."
"We'll see." He holds up the cigarette, looks at it.
"These things are fucking disgusting."
I laugh.
"They're all I got left."
He stubs it out, stands.
"I'm going to take a shower. Wait for me, and we'll go to breakfast."
He leaves. I sit and I wait and I smoke cigarettes and I drink coffee. I watch men begin to filter in and out of the unit. Some are doing their morning jobs. Some are getting coffee. Some are buying candy or cans of soda from the machines. I don't talk to any of them. I just sit and I stare out a window. I don't know what's outside the window, and I don't particularly care. It is but a point on which to focus my eyes while I drink and I smoke. I drink and I smoke. Leonard comes back into the upper level. He is clean, and his hair is wet. He says, "I'm hungry, let's eat." And I stand, and we walk to the dining hall. I get in line, and I get a plate of eggs and bacon, and he gets a plate of pancakes, and we find a table. We are joined by our friends. As we eat, we talk about the upcoming heavyweight championship. Maddie knows the fighters, and he speaks of the fight with great enthusiasm, stopping and swearing at himself for swearing, jabbing and moving as if he is in the ring. We sit and laugh, and after a few moments, everyone except Maddie stops talking. He talks enough for all of us.
After breakfast, another lecture. We play cards in the back row. After lecture, Joanne is waiting for me outside the hall. She says I am with her this morning, and we walk through the halls toward her office. The halls are bright, and I do not mind. When we walk inside, she sits down in one of the comfortable chairs, and I sit on the couch. She lights a cigarette, and I light a cigarette. She leans back, settles in, speaks.
You think about our conversation yesterday?
No.
Why?
Because I'm not going to change my mind, and I'm not going to bother thinking about changing my mind.
James, you are an incredibly addicted person. You have been told by qualified doctors that any drug or alcohol use is going to kill you. In all of my experience, I have never seen anyone stay sober and survive in the long term using anything but AA and the 12 steps. They may last a week, or a month, or in the best cases, a year, but without the necessary support, all of them start using again and most of them die. Is that really what you want?
I'd rather have that than spend my life sitting in church basements listening to people whine and bitch and complain. That's not productivity to me, nor is it progress. It is the replacement of one addiction with another, and if I'm going to be addicted to something, it's going to be something I like.
AA is not a replacement addiction. It is a support group based around the 12 steps.
You can look at it however you want, but when someone stops doing one thing every day and starts doing another thing every day, that seems like a replacement addiction to me.
She takes a deep, frustrated breath. Would you rather be addicted to something that makes you a better person and makes you healthier every day, or something that's going to kill you?
You can try whatever tricks you want. Taking my position or reverse psychology or whatever else you got in your bag, but I'm not going to believe in AA or the 12 steps. The whole thing is based on belief in God. I don't have that, and I never will.
It is based on a belief in a higher power, not God.
Same thing.
God, in our society, is a man with a long flowing beard who sits on a chair in heaven. You don't have to believe in that. A higher power can be anything you would like it to be, or anything that gets you through the day. It could be the sky, it could be Buddha, it could be the force from Star Wars. AA does not try to push any one higher power or religion or particular belief on you.
Let's get something straight before we talk about this anymore.
What?
Whether you're saying higher power or you're saying God, you're saying the same thing.
I think that's too general a statement. It discounts the diversity of the world's spiritual thought.
From where I sit, all religion and spiritual thought are the same thing. They exist to make people feel better about living, to give them some kind of moral code, and to help them feel better about dying by promising something better when their life ends, provided they follow all of God's rules.
Is something wrong with that purpose? I think it's bullshit. I don't need something that doesn't exist to tell me how to live. How can you be so sure that something greater than ourselves doesn't exist?
How can you be so sure it does?
Because I have faith in it.
I don't. She pauses, takes a deep breath, speaks.
What do you think faith is?
I think for a moment. I speak. Faith is the belief in something that can't be proven to exist.
Have you ever considered it?
Yes.
And why don't you have it?
I think God is something that people use to avoid reality. I think faith allows people to reject what is right in front of our eyes, which is that this thing, this life, this existence, this consciousness, or whatever word you want to use for it, is all we have, and all we'll ever have. I think people have faith because they want and need to believe in something, whatever that something is, because life can be hard and depressing and brutal if you don't.
You may be right, but what about accepting the idea that faith can make your life better?
I know my faith makes my life better, and whether what I believe in exists or not, because I have faith in it, I get the benefits of that faith.
I'm not going to ever have faith in God, or anything like God.
Do you have faith in love?
Meaning what?
Do you believe in love?
Yeah.
Do you believe it can make your life better?
Yeah.
Do you have faith in anything else?
Friendship.
You believe in friendship?
Very much so. Anything else? What's your point?
You can't prove love or friendship exist, but you still have faith in them. I'm asking you to try and apply the same principle to something greater than yourself.
I can feel love and friendship. I can see and touch and talk to the people I love and the people I choose to make my friends. The idea of God doesn't make me feel anything, and I can't see God or touch God or talk to God. Have you ever tried to open yourself up to the idea of faith? I've read the Bible. It didn't ring true to me. I know people who consider themselves close to God, but I've never understood their feelings. I've spent time in churches, and I can appreciate their beauty and majesty, but nothing good has ever happened to me in a church.
What does that mean?
Exactly what I said.
Is there something you aren't telling me?
Nothing that has anything to do with what we're talking about.
She stares at me.
I stare at her. She speaks.
I want you to think more about this and try to come to terms with it. I want you to stop intellectualizing it and try to open yourself to it.
I've never believed in God, not even as a little kid. I'm not going to start now.
Think about it.
Fine.
She stands, and I stand, and we walk to the door and she opens it. There are going to be some alterations to your program, which Ken will talk to you about this afternoon. Come back and talk to me when you're ready.
I walk out, and I walk through the halls. As I head to the unit, I see Leonard walking toward me. He tells me it's time for lunch, so we walk to the dining hall, and we find a table. We are joined by Ed and Ted, and Maddie and Miles and Bobby. Bobby tells stories and talks mountains of shit. I have this. I know this person. They owe me this much money. On and on and on. At one point, he starts talking about Las Vegas and a trip he took there for a meeting with Mikey the Nose. Leonard, who has been ignoring Bobby for most of lunch, starts listening to him. He does not speak. And it is not obvious that he's interested, but I can see him start to pay closer attention. Bobby says that Mikey was a fat, drunk pig, foolish with his money, and foolish with his mouth, and that when he was finally taken out, there were parties all over New York. Bobby says that he owed Mikey a fairly large sum of money, and that with Mikey's death, the debt disappeared. Bobby says that the last time he went to Las Vegas, he went and found Mikey's grave and took a piss on it. I watch Leonard as Bobby says these things. I watch his face remain a mask of calm. I watch his hands stay still upon the table. I know that if Bobby were saying these things about someone whom I loved, I'd be across the table and on his neck. Leonard just sits and listens. Leonard just sits and stares. We finish lunch and we stand and walk as a group to the lecture. We sit in the back and we play cards. For the first time since I have known him, Leonard loses every hand we play. Ted wins 3, Ed and Maddie win 2, Miles and I don't win any. When the lecture is over, everyone gives Leonard his money back. We leave. As we walk through the halls and toward the unit, Ken steps out of his office and he asks to speak with me. I step into his office and sit down, and he does the same.
There are a few things we need to talk about today.
He picks up a piece of paper and he passes it to me.
This is a release, so that we can have a lawyer who works here contact the states in which you have issues and try to begin sorting them out. You need to read it, write down the states and cities and what you think the problems are and sign it. You don't have to do it, but we highly recommend that you do.
You got a pen?
Sure.
He picks up a pen and he hands it to me. I take it. Start reading the document.
In a related or somewhat related issue, we've noticed that you've become close to Leonard.
We're a bit concerned about that.
I look up.
Why?
You're a young man, with a tenuous relationship with the law. We don't think that he's going to be a good influence on you.
Why is that?
Do you have any idea what Leonard does for a living?
He's a businessman of some sort.
Ken laughs.
What kind of business?
I haven't asked. Have you ever noticed that people are scared of Leonard?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because he lives without fear. That tends to scare people.
That's not the reason, James.
What is the reason, Ken?
I'm assuming you know more than you're telling me, but I'll say it anyway. Leonard is involved in organized crime. He's a fairly major figure in that world. He has been asked not to discuss or flaunt what he does, and because he has real and serious chemical dependency issues, we did not turn him away. But we do keep a fairly close eye on him.
I shrug. Everybody's got to make a living.
That's your reaction?
That's my reaction.
We don't think you should spend so much time with him. We believe it's going to negatively impact your recovery.
Leonard and I are friends. I like him, and I trust him, and I respect him. I can't see how having a friend like that is going to hurt me.
Has he ever asked you to do anything illegal?
I laugh.
No.
Has he ever told you what he does for a living?
He says he's a businessman. He doesn't say much else.
I would like a definition of much else.
I'm not talking about this anymore, Ken.
It's for your own good, James.
Next issue, Ken.
He takes a deep breath, and he looks down at a stack of papers on his desk. He looks up.
Your parents are coming here. They've enrolled in the family program.
What?
We've been talking to them fairly regularly since you got here, and they've decided that they want to come to the family program. Everyone involved thinks it's a good idea.
You think about checking with me?
We had an idea about what your reaction would be.
When did they get here?
Tomorrow.
They're coming from Japan?
Yes.
I shake my head, and I stare at the floor. I let it come, and it comes fast. Anger, rage, hatred, shame, and horror. Fusing into the fury, the perfect, beautiful, and terrible fury. I can't do anything with it, and I can't do anything to stop it unless I drink and kill it, or do drugs and kill it, or do both and kill it. I clench my jaw, and I ball my fists, and I fight myself. I want to get fucked up.
You okay?
I look at Ken.
No. What are you feeling?
I am angry.
Anything else?
I want to drink.
Anything else?
Get fucked up.
Anything else?
I want to jump over your goddamn desk and knock your fucking teeth down your throat.
Do I need to call security?
I take a deep breath.
What's going to happen when they get here?
I clench my jaw.
You'll stay on the unit at night and eat your meals as you usually do, but your day will be spent in the family center.
I squeeze my fists. And what happens there?
You'll engage in group therapy with the other patients and family members, and you'll spend some one-on-one time with your parents.
I hold on. Sounds fucking great.
Why don't you want them here?
Because I don't.
Why?
I'm not talking to you about it anymore.
I look down at the release he has given me, write down the names of the cities and the states, and I hand it back to him.
Anything else?
I think we need to start working on getting at the source of your anger.
I look at him and I laugh, and I stand up and I walk out of his office. The halls are bright, and the fury inside of me wants them down, full of holes, reduced to rubble. I hate these fucking halls. I want to destroy them, destroy myself, destroy everything. I breathe deeply and I hold on and I walk toward the unit. I want to go outside and I want to breathe free air. I want air that is not of this place and I want space that is not of this place. I want no walls, no halls, no units, no counselors, no rules, no God, no higher powers, no steps, no groups, no lectures, no dining hall. Nobody to see, talk, to deal with. I want to breathe. Free, empty air. I walk through the upper level, and I walk down to the lower level, and through a group session Lincoln is leading, and he asks me what I'm doing, and I ignore him, and I open the glass doors, and I step outside, and I breathe, 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 and the air is free. I start walking. I have no idea where I'm going. I'm just walking. I take a trail, and I follow it, and it leads me into the cover of evergreen. It's darker in here, and I feel less vulnerable and more comfortable. I am breathing deeply as I can breathe, and the air is calming me down. The fury has dissipated and is a walking rage, an anger like fire, entirely controllable and easy to stop it from burning or hurting anything. The sun is high, its light shattered by tree branches. Their streams illuminate dirt, dead leaves, and rotting plants killed by the winter's cold. Frost sparkles in the shade, waiting to melt. In an hour, it will be gone. In 10 hours, it will return. Another day, another cycle here, gone back tomorrow, gone again. I am cold. Warmth is in the light, but I avoid it. As I walk, I'll get warmer. I'm in no hurry. I follow the trail, and the trail leads me along the lake. The lake is the same as it is each day the same. Sheets of ice, life below, birds above. Noise destroying silence, silence overwhelming noise. Reflections slowly move along the water, distorting what is real, the object or the image. They are both real, and it is all real. It all is in front of me, life is in front of me, and behind me, above me, below me, surrounding me. I can see it, and feel it, and hear it, and touch it, inside and outside, right now. A bench is empty. I sit down, close my eyes, open myself. I don't know to what I am opening myself. Is it God or something higher? Is it me or what is around me? Does it matter? Do I need to know? It matters because it is what is keeping me together. This opening is allowing me to pick up the pieces of a shattered life. I need to believe in it to continue to believe in me. I need to know what it is. What is it that opens me? I stand and I walk along the edge of the water until it ends in a sea of yellow grass. The grass is dead now, but will return in the spring. That is the way of the world. Things die, and they return. Is that biology or God or something higher? Are we biology or God or something higher? I know my heart beats, and I listen to it. The beat is biology, but what is the song? Will this song exist when the beating stops? Will one stay when one is gone? Can one live without the other? Does it matter? It does. I have to believe in something. It is holding me together. Up the pine walk and across the murky desolation of swamp and rot and life existing because of death, back down into dense oak and evergreen. The sun is still hot and high, its rays still scattered, still dancing across the floor of earth, and my feet are moving easily. The fury is gone, replaced with free air and the quiet emptiness of a solitary calm. I am quiet and empty. I am calm. If there is anything I seek, it is this, the calm. If there is God or something higher for me, it is this, the calm. If there is something that will hold me when I need to hold, it is this, the calm. There is no anger, no rage, no fury. There is no want, no need, no desire. There is no hatred, no shame, no regret. There is no grief, no sadness, no depression. There is no fear. Absolutely no fear. When one lives without fear, one cannot be broken. When one lives with fear, one is broken before one begins to live. The calm I feel right now, what is it? I am lost in the woods, but still on a trail. I am seeking that which I have, but will lose again. I have sought it before, as a cure for the disease of myself. In a church as a child, it did not come. I held my parents' hands, and I felt nothing. Love only brought me loneliness and horror. In bottles and pipes I found emptiness and pain. At 22, after jail and bond and flight, I went back to a cathedral where what I sought was calm. The calm did not come. I have it now. Without God, I have it now. The wood fades into brittle brown grass, and a slope carries me to a point where I can see all that surrounds me. I can see trees and woods and swamps and lakes and birds and animals and men and women and the buildings of the clinic and the sky and whatever is beyond the sky. I can hear the wind and water and the cries of flying birds and the screams of the patients locked down and detoxifying. I can feel them, and I can feel myself. I can feel the life in them, and the life around me. I can feel it in the beating calm of my heart. It is not God, and it is not something higher. This feeling of calm is of me, within me, from me, and created by me. It is not God. It is not something higher. I sit, and I stare at the world. I see it, and I hear it, and I touch it, and I feel it. It is what it is. Dirt and rock and water and sun and air and waves of light and waves of sound, made up of definable elements. It can be created or reproduced by man at will. Science has given us that power. There is no mystery to it. We can create it all in a laboratory. There is no mystery anymore, as there was at the dawn of history, when no one knew what or how or why. We have answers now, answers that reveal truth. Truth is not God, and it is not a higher power. There is no God. There is no higher power. I let it in through the open of my calm. There is no God. There is no higher power. I let it into the deep, simple center of what I am, which is biology and energy and a beating heart that sings in a language only I can speak. I let it in, and it mixes and settles with the calm. There is nothing else. I will not fight God anymore. I will not fight anything higher. Fighting is an acknowledgement of existence. I no longer need to fight or acknowledge what I know is not there. There are still fights to be fought, and I will fight them, but not with the blind faith of a false conversion to a belief in that which does not, has not, will not ever exist, God or something higher. I will fight with me, my heart, my will, myself, my song. I will fight with me. I may win, I may lose. It doesn't matter either way. What matters is how I do it. There is no God, and there is no such thing as a higher power. I will do it with me, alone. I will do it with me. I know it is almost time to meet Lily. I stand and I walk down the hill, past the screams, along the buildings by the unit. I walk back to the trail, and the trail leads me to the point where I leave it, and I push it aside until I am in the clearing. She is there waiting for me. She is waiting for me, walking toward me. She kisses me, kisses me, kisses me. She pulls away and she smiles. Hi. I smile. Hi. Let's sit. Okay. We sit. I missed you. I smile. Good. She smiles. It's a sweet, subtle smile. The type of smile that would break your heart if you stared at it too long. She is still holding my hand, and I am still calm, and now I'm high. High on me and high on her. She speaks.
Can I kiss you again?
Yeah. She leans, kisses me, kisses me. I am high. She kisses me. She pulls away, speaks.
Tell me a story.
It's your turn.
I want you to start.
Why?
Because you're braver than me.
Why do you think that?
Just tell me a story.
What do you want to hear?
Tell me A story about love.
I'm no expert on love, but I'll try.
Thanks.
I stare into her eyes. They are clear blue like water. They comfort me as if I'm thirsty. I speak.
I went to school with this girl. I spent 3 years staring at her and thinking about her and waiting for her to talk to me. I knew she knew I stared at her, but if I was the first to talk, I knew she'd think I was crazy, so I let her be the first. My last year there, we had some classes together, and after the first day of the first class, she waited for me, and we had a short conversation. She asked why I stared at her, and I told her what I had been waiting to tell her since the first time I saw her, which was that she was the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. She asked me if the stories she had heard about me were true, and I told her that they probably were. We didn't talk for a while after that, and I stopped staring at her, but I knew she'd miss my stares and that sooner or later she'd come around to me. I was right. 2 months into the semester, she asked if I wanted to study for midterms with her. After we studied, we went out for drinks with her friends. I didn't bring any drugs with me and drank only enough to control my shakes and tremors, and it went well. We started hanging around together all the time, studying, walking to class, eating lunch, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, drinking beers, doing whatever, and we became really close. My drinking slowed down to night hours only, and I also stopped selling drugs. I take a breath, look at the ground, remember. The memories are good ones, some of the few that I have. I look back at Lily. Christmas came around, and she went home to Connecticut, and I went to Brazil, where my parents were living at the time. She gave me the number at her parents' place and told me to call her, and though I wanted to call, I never did. I figured it was better to let her miss me, the idea being that her missing me would somehow work to change things between us. I wanted more, much, much more. I thought I would be happy if she loved me. I thought her love would help solve my problems, and mostly, I loved her, and I wanted her to feel the same thing I did. Lily smiles, shakes her head, speaks.
Bad move.
What?
Thinking love could solve your problems.
I nod. Yeah.
You mad that I said that?
I shake my head. Hard to be mad when something's true. She smiles.
I want to hear the rest.
I chuckle. When we got back to school, she asked why I didn't call her. I told her I figured she was busy with her family and that I didn't want to intrude. She smiled and told me that from now on I should intrude whenever I felt like it. I smiled and tried to be calm, but I wasn't calm. My heart started thumping and my hands started shaking. She didn't say it, but I knew. She had missed me. A couple days later, we went to a bar to meet some of her friends. She sat closer to me than she normally did, laughed a little louder at my stupid jokes, touched me more affectionately on my leg, my shoulder, the back of my neck,